You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 28th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, New York Times Magazine Washington correspondent Matt Leibovich on his, Mark Leibovich on his book, Our Town, will join us. Also on the program today, we'll get to that story about medical devices and how they're driving up the costs of our health care. Flood insurance. Getting a little pricey these days. I wonder why. For coastal towns. We'll get to that story on the new slumlords. More revelations. We're up to what? 35 now? Leaders of state that we are spying on to keep us safe from the terrorists. And apparently, millions of them running around Spain, too, now. Yes, we must keep Monsanto safe from the terrorists. Also, correction. On Friday, Cliff Schechter and I said we'll never have to say the words grand bargain again. And probably while we were saying those words, a top economic advisor to President Obama saying, we should be saying those words more often, particularly when it comes to cuts in our social insurance programs. And the sad story of a racially, or I should say, hate attack by a guy in Wisconsin. And just sadly, he just was a little bit off on who it was that he was hating. But nevertheless, it's quite a story. We will get to all that and more. I don't generally talk about passings of people who are more cultural icons. But Lou Reed died over the weekend. He had severe liver problems for a while. And he, of course, was the lead singer of and sort of the driving force behind the Velvet Underground, which I imagine most of you are aware that used to be said, at least back in the 90s and on, that very few people bought a Velvet Underground album, but everybody who did started a band. And certainly all the music that those of us who came of age in those in the 80s and 90s, the best music was all in some way derived. It all had some Velvet Underground DNA in it. And I remember, I was just fortunate that a buddy of mine, his sister was older, and we were listening to Loaded, the Velvet Underground, probably the most produced of their albums, I would say, in seventh grade. And then I became very anti-disco. That was what was happening at that time. And I once met Lou Reed in Köln, Germany. I was traveling junior year, and for the summer, John Benjamin and I and my buddy Charlie also, we were traveling around Europe doing that college kid thing. And we had started to take pictures of, basically, we were so late on the trigger with our camera when we ran into people who we were, really, the only other person we ran into was Richard Lewis. And we took a picture of his butt because we got people as they were walking away. And we were in an American Express. Back in those days, you traveled with traveler's checks. And you'd have to go to an American Express in the town to go cash checks, so you'd have some cash, you know, staying in the hostels, the youth hostels thing. And Lou Reed was in there, and just it was just us and Lou Reed, and we were just too nervous to say anything to him. But we just started singing all of the Velvet Underground songs that we do.
So you're too nervous to say how you doing to the guy, but not too nervous to start like belting his music out in front of him?
Well,
that's
we
incredible.
Were,
I
we
love
were a
the
little bit
process.
Awkward. We were a little awkward. And but I did at one point, I went up to the counter to cash check, and there was an umbrella there. And I thought that he and the woman he was traveling with had left the umbrella. So I went up to Lou Reed and said, "Is this your umbrella?" And he said, "No." And he turned to his travel companion and says, "Is this your umbrella?" And she said, "No." And he looked back at me and goes, "No." And I will always remember that moment. And then as soon as he walked out of the American Express office, we took a picture of him walking away. So we have a great photo of Lou Reed walking away from us. But he also was... heavily, at least, involved, I don't know, heavily is the right word, but he was very supportive of Occupy. I know that he was in attendance and probably was just not doing well physically when I moderated that panel on Bradley Manning some months ago. And so he was, you know, one of those guys who was politically active, and you know, so I don't know. I just wanted to mark it. You know, it's a big loss. He's 71, and obviously he lived a fairly hard life, so not shocking. But all right, folks. So we'll leave you. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mark Labovich, and we will leave you. About his book, This Town, and we will leave you with Sweet Jane. We'll be right back.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand. Jackson's corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Huh. Riding a Stutz Bearcat, Jim. You know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes. CJ!
Hey, listeners of the Majority Report, you've heard me talk about our sponsor for this month. I'm talking about Credo Mobile. They are a dream sponsor. It's one of those sponsors where their agenda aligns with the agenda of this program. That is to fight regressive policies, whether you're talking about fighting against Tea Party members of the House or fighting against weak-kneed Democrats. Credo Mobile donates a huge chunk, 1% of their revenues, to progressive nonprofits. They've given over $75 million since 1985 to places like the Rainforest Action Network, Democracy Now!, the ACLU. They've got 3 million activists who fight for things like Medicare and against the Keystone XL pipeline. Credo Mobile helps fuel this Credo action fights. You can join today. Go to credomobile.com/Sam, and you got a deal that runs only till October 31st. They'll give you $350, or up to $350, I should say, credit for switching over if your current provider charges you a fee. They'll also give you 25% discount on data for 2 years, and that's true unlimited data. So check it out now. Go to credomobile.com/Sam, or we got links on the homepage of majority.fm. Check it out today. Help sponsor this program. Help a sponsor that is fighting for the same things that you're fighting for. Do it now.
And Jean, she is a clerk. And both of them save their monies. And when they come home from work, sitting down by the fire. The march of the winter soldiers, all your protesters, you can hear Jack say, get ready. See Jack, come on baby, see Jack, see Jack. Some people, they
we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Mark Leibovich. He is the Washington correspondent, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and author of This Town. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you, Sam. Good to be here.
I really enjoyed your book. I mean, I found it also really terribly depressing. I'm sure you hear that a decent amount.
I've heard
amount.
That quite a bit, yeah.
Some of the stories of the individuals I have covered over the years, and I want to get into some of the individuals, but I want to sort of broaden it out, because one of the things I really found fascinating about the book, and, you know, we all approach these things from our own eyes, but
sure.
Back when I was in sort of entertainment, straight entertainment,
right.
I guess,
yeah.
I had a similar perspective on what was going on in Hollywood. In fact, the
right.
only things that I made that were any way remotely successful were basically indictments of the Hollywood world. And I'm interested in how, I mean, and people should know just in general that you tell the story of what we refer to on this program and others as of the village, the sort of the permanent sort of establishment class there. And you document how it's sort of gone beyond where we could have wildly imagined. But just give us a sense, just a broad sense at first, and then I want to talk about,
sure.
compare it to other things, but of just how you would describe the interconnection here and what it brings about.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think, first of all, it's important to define our terms. I mean, this town does not intend to refer to a comprehensive look at all of Washington, D.C., and in fact, it constitutes a very small group of people, population-wise. I mean, this is the political class. People in this town are people in the political class, people who are elected officials, who are on staffs, who are lobbyists, who are members of the media, people who are disproportionate in their power and their attention and the money they make. And almost always, these are the people who are yelling at each other on TV or on the floors of Congress about whether the government shut down, and they are not people who will be affected by the government shutdown. These are people who will all be paid anyway. And these are not the people who lost their lives at the Naval Yard last month. I mean, these are not people who are anonymous and work really, really hard and don't care about how many Twitter followers they have, and they don't care about being on CNN at 2 p.m. and they can tell all their Facebook friends about it. I mean, this is a group that just, again, is outsized in the attention it gets. So this is the subculture I wanted to write about. And it's, I mean, one of the criticisms of the book and has been, and I don't, I mean, this is I think on the whole, I mean, it's been very well received, but I think one of the criticisms has been that, I don't focus on the do-gooders, the anonymous people, the people who are in it for the right reasons and so forth. And I plead completely guilty to that. I mean, I think someone else should do that book, but I mean, this is the carnival I wanted to focus on.
Well, and part of, I mean, you know, to the extent that criticism is fair, I mean, what the real story, it seems to me here, is there's always been those people,
absolutely,
the do-gooders, and
yeah, totally,
and to some extent, there's always been an establishment. I mean, Sally Quinn was famous for saying that the Clintons came into Washington and trashed their place. But right. what is different between the sort of the village that Sally Quinn was talking about and the village that you write about?
Yeah, no, what's different is that over the last, I would say, decade, but maybe two decades, you have had an incredible explosion of money into the system, into the political system, I mean, which extends, obviously, to campaigns, lobbying, consulting, just the public relations industry, and there's just so much more money to be made in the political system now than there ever was before. And as a result of that, you've had a lot more people coming to Washington to get rich, whereas that was not the case 30, 40 years ago. So it's become much more of a moneyed entourage class than it ever was, even back in, you know, in the Reagan days. In addition to that, I mean, new media has completely revolutionized this conversation and has really changed the ecosystem a lot, to a point where, I mean, cable has given pretty much any C-list political operative a face.
Guilty.
And anyone can, well, it's okay, you know.
I'm not a political operative, but nevertheless.
No, but I mean, look, I mean, it's like, it is definitely expanded the population of people who, you know, can make a name for themselves and even profit from that name. I mean, with the perception that they are a Washington insider and so forth. So, I mean, it's become this anarchy in the peanut gallery, and I think new media and to some degree, not old media, but I mean, things like, again, cable and the internet have enabled that quite a bit.
It's interesting because, you know, the sort of, I guess, the conventional wisdom or what we hear sold by what seems to be the sort of the deepest nexus of this group seems to be their line seems to be that the problem with Washington is the polarization on some level.
Yeah.
But your book shows that the polarization is really just more of almost the sort of the roles that people are playing,
right,
to further a nexus that is without any political ideology in some way other than to make money.
Yeah, I mean, one of the takeaways from this book that I certainly saw in a much fuller sense of relief than I ever did before is the distinction not so much between Democrats and Republicans in Washington, but insiders versus outsiders. And which is not to say that that politics today isn't polarized and that the partisanship that drives so much of the dysfunction in national politics isn't real. I mean, it's absolutely real. But I think there is, in many cases, a kind of wink and a nod that, hey, there's a show business aspect to this, too, and we are playing roles. And I'm a professional Democrat and a professional Republican. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, Ted Cruz, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what happens to him because he, just because of the system as it exists today, I mean, he is set for life, right? I mean, he doesn't care about, you know, what senators have typically cared about over the years, which is the respect of his colleagues, which is committee assignments, which is, you know, raising money from the right donors. I mean, he is set for life because he has sort of, because of today's system, he has set about trying to get famous. He will probably run for president in 2016, and whether he wins or he loses, he will be absolutely fine. He will be, you know, he'll get speaking money, he'll probably get a TV show, he'll be an icon. And you can, you know, Sarah Palin's a great example of someone who served very little time in office and can basically make tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, in the comfort of her own living room and her own TV studio. I mean, so she can just sort of press a button and all of a sudden she is Sarah Palin Inc. And that's sort of the world we live in today. But ultimately, it is a role-playing game. And I think once you are inside Washington, you see that much more clearly than maybe you do outside.
Well, what's fascinating to me, I mean, you bring up Ted Cruz, is that it's almost as if, because, you know, one of the things that I'm quite convinced of is that the reason why we see the rise of Ted Cruz and that ilk is that there is, it's almost another separate industry that is at loggerheads with that establishment industry in D.C. It's almost, you know, like people spoke about the swipe fees legislation as really two industries that were fighting it out.
And
on some level, what we're seeing, I think, with the sort of the conservative movement that is a it's Amway versus, sort of something that is more sort of some Fortune 500 company that's industries that are fighting with each other, but everybody's getting paid.
Yeah, everybody's getting paid. I mean, I think maybe a better analogy, I mean, maybe is something like, I don't know, Google versus Microsoft or something. I mean, Google being the upstart colossus, whereas Microsoft was the existing establishment colossus. I mean, the swipe fees thing is a good example. I mean, Huffington Post has done a lot of good reporting on this. But again, it's posturing, it's positioning, and you, and the grassroots are extremely powerful. I mean, I think it's not too much of a stretch to say that the grassroots, hope and change, whatever you want to call it, that elected Barack Obama is not terribly distinct from the grassroots fed up with Washington that has propelled the Tea Party and Ted Cruz and on the left, the Occupy movement. I mean, obviously there are different characteristics here, but I think that, look, I mean, this is a different strain of populism. It's one that's driven very much by online energy. But I also think that it's real, and I think that it's become a force to be reckoned with, and I think that it's definitely changed the game.
Well, but what I mean by the difference why I would sort of parse out something like Occupy versus what we're seeing on this sort of on the right, for instance, is just simply that there is no George Soros, sadly, is not dumping $500 million per cycle into the machine that exists in the populist left. I mean, for obvious reasons. But that money is, there's so much money floating around in that popular right that it is creating a whole ecosystem of people who, while their agenda may not be good for their policies in the long term, although arguably it is, that gets divorced from the fact that they're just making a huge amount of money by saying whatever it is. People in Washington out of touch.
No. I mean, it's cynical. And one, I mean, what's interesting is that, I mean, a lot of the term, I mean, you heard pieces of this back in 94 when, the Gingrich Republican Revolution, I mean, they were all talking about term limits, right? That was like one of the two or three big platform issues during that election. And what happens is, I mean, it's a great message on the stump, in the same way that, hope and change is a great message on the stump. And then you get here, and I think, more than half of the people who made that pledge wound up, wiggling out of it somehow, and many of them are still in Congress now. And I think what's striking is, yes, big money is behind a lot of this. I mean, I think we did a story, the Times did a story a few weeks ago on how, a lot of very, very well-heeled conservative groups like the Koch brothers were very, very instrumental in the lead-up to the government shutdown, and this was sort of an end game that a lot of very, very well-heeled interests had envisioned from a very, very early point in all these discussions. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's good for business. It's a winning message. I mean, that's a completely cynical view of this, but it's a really vicious cycle, and frankly, the Ted Cruzes of the world can benefit.
Let's talk about, I mean, you compared this permanent industry that is sort of has grown up around D.C. And it's, there's always been that sense of it being a company town. I was there 27 years ago as an intern on the Hill. And I just remember it, you know, 5 years later, 6 years later, I was in Hollywood, and it was very similar. You're constantly running into everybody who's feeding off this one sort of company town. But tell me how else you perceive the sort of both how Washington has become some way similar in dynamic to Hollywood, and in some ways they've also become intermeshed. I mean, particularly through the right. Washington Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is always, I mean, especially, you know, really starting with the Clinton years, there's been this symbiosis between Hollywood and just the celebrity culture of Hollywood and the celebrity culture of Washington. I mean, the Correspondents' Dinner is part of this, but I mean, there's a fairly long history of parallels between the small towns and the big egos of Hollywood and those in Washington, D.C., right? And I think what's always worth pointing out is that Washington, unlike Hollywood, is for keeps. I mean, this was a city that was built supposedly on public service. It is not make-believe like Hollywood is. And but no, I mean, look, people come to the Correspondents' Dinner. I mean, there is a sex appeal to Hollywood, to Washington, that was really kind of epitomized by the West Wing, during the late Clinton, early Bush years, but really has gone, you know, there's been this morphing under the umbrella of pop culture that did not, again, exist before. And, after a while, you have this class of famous people on TV versus the rest of us. And again, that's a big piece of that insider v. outsider world that we see here, that is, again, distinct from the left v. right world that everyone perceives to be at the root of all of this.
I had a theory about people going to Hollywood that, in terms of the way that they would change, and the analogy was just that sort of there was a latent, like almost like a latent allergy, and until you got into this environment, you didn't realize that you had this allergy, and it would change you in some way. Like, you know, I need to move out to the country before I realize that I'm horribly allergic to pollen. And when I was reading the part about Chris Dodd, that was the only thing I could think about. Just tell us sort of the Chris Dodd story, or as you tell.
Sure, no. I mean, Chris Dodd, you know, longtime senator from Connecticut, very committed Democrat, had a very, very productive end to his career. I mean, he spearheaded the Dodd-Frank financial services reform bill. He was in the middle of the health care debate. He was head of the HELP committee, one of the key writers of the health care bill, and he was retiring. He was quite unpopular in Connecticut. I mean, it was sort of part of a trend in which your influence in Washington became disproportionate to your popularity with voters, and he was in some real trouble in 2010, so he decided not to run.
We should also say he was getting some very cushy mortgages.
Yeah, he had Countrywide mortgage. Yeah, he was involved in a scandal involving Countrywide and some, you know, campaign contributions and special treatment or alleged special treatment on a deal. Anyway, I was doing a story on him that summer, and I remember sitting with him in the Senate dining room and saying, "Senator, what are you going to do now? I mean, your life is wide open." And he had this look of incredible possibility about him, and he's like, "You know, I might join the Peace Corps again." I mean, he did that early in his life, and you know, I might go out to Silicon Valley and join a startup, or I might, you know, at that point he had been mentioned as a possible president of the University of Connecticut. And I said, "Well, you're not going to lobby, are you?" He goes, no, of course not. I will take this off the table right now. You know, life is filled with possibilities. I'm going to try to expand my horizons." And sadly, you can sort of tell where this story ends. Chris Dodd is now one of the most powerful lobbyists in Washington, D.C. He represents the Motion Pictures Association of America, which is the most powerful lobby for Hollywood. And look, I don't blame him. I mean, he can make a living. He can make his $1.5 million a year, and he's certainly entitled to that. But I think, you know, the title of the chapter that you're referring to is institutionalized, I think, and it does give you a sense of once you're on the inside, it can be hard to leave. I mean, it's obviously a very luxury. It's a luxurious prison, but it's a prison nonetheless.
I mean, it's interesting because I don't get the sense. I mean, I don't know if you had the sense, but that he was lying to you at the time. I mean, I think it was.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think so either. I think he was being sincere or trying to be sincere. I think his, you know, I don't think it was a lie. Maybe his as we say in Washington, his thinking evolved on the subject. But no, I mean, my book charts a lot of this. I mean, what I tried to do in this town is really give a sense, you know, and hopefully in a fun way, of how this prison works, how this carnival works, how really there aren't any losers, how it's really quite an easy town, not a tough town. It's a place where there's always a next act, and more than ever, there's always a paycheck. So, I don't know. I mean, I think, but Dodd is, you know, he's obviously part of an ensemble of a lot of characters who are in this category.
Yeah, tell us about Kurt Bardella.
Okay. Well, Kurt Bardella is longtime aide to Daryl Issa, who became a unwitting, or actually quite witting, character in the book. He was someone I was focusing on, and he started sending me emails from members of Congress, and forwarding emails from members of Congress and other members of the media to me in the guise of helping me to understand how his days were spent. And Politico learned of this, and it became a mini-scandal when it was learned that he was, unbeknownst to the actual senders of the emails, sending emails to a reporter writing a book, i.e. me. And so suddenly he lost his job. It became a huge story, at least in the tiny village of Capitol Hill, for about a week. And you know, Kurt was totally disgraced, and in the vein of "you will always have lunch in this town again," he of course got his old job back within a few months. He's now a more visible than ever strategist working on a number of conservative causes. And the saga is laid out writ large in chapter 8.
I mean, it goes to, it's in some ways it just sort of shows that, like, you cannot, the worst thing you can do in Washington in terms of your career is to not get into the pages of your book or into Politico. I mean, there's no, you cannot be shamed. In fact, to be shamed is really the worst thing that you can do, because you got to get back out there and be loud and proud about, that your brand in some way.
I know yeah, it's kind of depressing, I got to be honest with you. I mean, I've gotten as many complaints from people who are not in this book, from people who are in this book.
And, well, Lanny Davis, yikes. Tell a story just about Lanny Davis, because
I have to give him any more publicity?
Well,
now Lanny Davis is shameless public relations guy. His expertise apparently is crisis communications, and Lanny, very visible figure. He was not in the book. He called me immediately, expressing quote unquote thanks for not keeping him in, but in fact he was appalled not to be in. And I of course then told that story one of my early book promo interviews, and Lanny kept getting more and more attention. And it turns out after a few days I was probably talking more about Lanny Davis, who wasn't in the book, more than I was talking about people who were actually in the book. So no, Lanny is a classic guy who has made Washington work for him. He is someone on TV. He is someone who, you know, likes to think he is worth knowing, and a lot of people apparently are willing to pay for it.
And that is, I mean, that is almost sort of the perfect metaphor for the dynamic that you're talking about, because when you're mentioning him on whatever it is on Morning Joe, his stock rises, and he will get more from whatever horrible dictator he's going to lobby on behalf of.
Absolutely.
In DC.
No, it's a vicious cycle. I mean, Daniel Snyder, the owner of the Washington Redskins, recently retained him to, I think, largely help in his defense of the name Redskins, which many people find offensive to Native Americans, racist, and what have you. I think it seems about right that the two of them would find each other.
I want to talk a little bit about Harry Reid, because I think Harry Reid's a very interesting character in the context of your book. Yeah. Because, I mean, I've heard you say that your first go through, your publisher wanted, you know, there to be a protagonist who could be the sort of the one that we can relate to and look at this
all
world.
True.
And I really appreciate the fact that there really isn't one. Because you're talking about
a
system.
Cop out.
Well, just tell us, like, you know, about that part of it, because, you know, I hate to bring this back to me, but the movie I made was very much like that. We had only despicable characters in the film, because that's
totally
the reality.
True. I mean, look, sometimes an ensemble works better than, like, the single, defining protagonist. I mean, I just didn't I didn't find that person. It probably would have been easier for narrative's sake, for you know, for maybe for clarity's sake, to have that one person, that one Mr. Smith, that one Frank Underwood, whatever you want to, you know, whoever, whatever Washington protagonist you want to, you know, put in there. But you know, look, I mean, this is a profile of a system. It's a profile of what the city has become, and it's not so much a profile of any one person, and you know, I don't want to pick on any one people, but I think in so much as people, or a group of people, don't come off looking well here, I mean, I think that's as much a product of them being co-opted, them being institutionalized in this sort of Chris Dodd-like way or any other way, and that's the book I wanted to write, so, or I wound up writing.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Harry Reid, because I'm sort of fascinated. In the book, you mentioned that Harry Reid, and you know, I've known people that have worked for him, and I have a sense of who he is, and some, you know, to the extent that one can have a sense from a distance. But what really interests me, and you know, this has come out before, that he had basically approached Barack Obama, and it's hard to know who the determinant voice was for Obama when, because I imagine there was a lot of them when he decided to challenge Hillary Clinton.
Right.
But there seems, I mean, now to be a tension between their two agendas, frankly. I'm just curious what your thoughts about that.
Well, they have worked pretty well together. I mean, I would say still that Obama, President Obama, would probably say that Harry Reid has been his chief legislative partner, you know, during his presidency. I mean, Harry Reid has a lot more. First of all, he's got a fair amount of control over his caucus. I mean, relative to the diversity of sort of ideological thought there. And look, Reid is very old school. I mean, he's very boss-like in some ways. I mean, he can make things happen and is in a position to make things happen far better than, you know, Nancy Pelosi is, in part because he's in a majority. But, no, I mean, they're both, I mean, President Obama, one thing that's missed about him in all the hope and change and stuff is that he's a very pragmatic kind of old school athlete in some ways. He is someone who, he likes mob movies. He likes loyal fixer types. And Harry Reid is a Vegas, you know, former organized crime, prosecutor. I mean, he knows that world. He knows pragmatism. And I think, look, obviously they have had hiccups. I mean, they have very, very distinct objectives. And, you know, right now, Harry Reid wants to keep the Senate. I mean, that's what will he keep him going. He'll probably run again. And, I think as President Obama's second term gets closer to being finished, I mean, I think their agendas will diverge even more. But, I mean, at heart, they're both in some ways points on the board guys. And, I mean, President Obama could not have gotten health care done and couldn't gotten probably the stimulus done without Senator Reid.
And the latest came out. I mean, there was some reporting in the Huffington Post about a meeting they had in July where apparently President Obama was questioning whether or not Harry Reid had control of his caucus.
Right.
And Harry Reid expressed his frustration over the White House's role in the fiscal cliff negotiations.
Right. No, I mean, look, that there have been meetings like that for a while. And I think, look, President Obama knows the Senate. I mean, he certainly knows the Senate better than he knows the House. And he knows how big and how thankless Harry Reid's job is. I think it's probably a little bit less thankless than what John Boehner's job is at this point. Probably even Mitch McConnell's, you know, job at this point. Because, I mean, Harry Reid doesn't have a Ted Cruz in his caucus right now. Look, no, I mean, I think there is obviously going to be some frustrations. I mean, Harry Reid is nothing if not calculating and, you know, some would even say Machiavellian. And, I think, you know, it'll be fascinating to watch it play out. But I think that look, it's basically worked. I think these marriages are never ideal, especially when you have, such divergent personalities, but I think it's generally worked.
What do you think happened to the President Obama? President Obama came in with sort of a very ambitious agenda to end at least some of this lobbying culture, and seems to have, I mean, to the extent that he
worked.
He seems to have failed if that was, you know, really his agenda, and it has continued to grow. I mean, do we have something that's sort of analogous to the sort of the deep state that people talk about when they talk about things like the national security that has grown up?
Well, I mean, look, I think that it's very, I mean, I guess I would question how hard President Obama really tried to change Washington. He certainly campaigned hard on the theme. You do wonder if he could have done more, even early on, whether it was more than just one Super Bowl party or one bipartisan cocktail party or what have you, whether that might have actually bought more goodwill that could have made any changes whatsoever. But look, I mean, the Tea Party didn't really exist in 2008. I mean, it was, I guess you could see the roots of it then, and you could argue all day about what has driven the Tea Party and whether it's genuine frustration or genuine, or just, you know, a different name for extreme conservatism, or populism. But I think, look, I do question, I mean, I think what's clear is that President Obama has moved this forward not at all as far as changing the tone of Washington. And I think he's clearly seems to have given up. But I also think that, again, I think the question of how hard he's tried is very, very valid.
I mean, they came out with this rule that this sort of cutting down on the revolving door and then just sort of provided waivers.
There were many, many exceptions. And, like, look, they're allowed to make exceptions and change their minds or flip-flops. And, look, I'm allowed to be demoralized as someone who you just become cynical watching this, and especially when you're a reporter and you're spoken to in the language of obsequiousness and lies and spin. I mean, it's not how normal people talk to each other. So, look, I mean, I hope that this town sort of lays it out, you know, pretty well. I mean, I think that there are a lot of books to write about Washington, but I do think I don't apologize for writing a book that might not be all that respectful of the political culture that we have come to see every day.
You don't provide any prescriptions for this problem in some ways, but I mean, yeah. How is for those of us who are sort of interested in bringing about specific policy change, and you sort of, you lay out this snapshot of a system which succeeds in certain policy changes not happening in some respect.
Right.
Now you've had some time to sort of absorb, I guess, and read the book almost as a consumer, on some level,
yeah,
at least.
Sure.
How do we exploit this?
I mean, well, let me tell you this. I mean, I will say this. I mean, just as someone who, I mean, I've experienced this as a reader, but also now as a listener, someone who has been all over the country and who has heard what people have said about not just the book, but also the system that it describes. And I would say the single biggest thirst out there from people I've spoken to is, I mean, especially after reading the book, is for some kind of campaign finance regulation or I mean, I just don't know of anyone who thinks that this is sustainable or that it won't beget some kind of terrible scandal. And that's on both sides. You hear a lot of talk these days, more than maybe you did 5-10 years ago, about term limits. I think that's still out there. You certainly hear a lot of hunger, or you hear a lot of people voicing a lot of desire or hunger for a third party candidate. I mean, I think that America is ripe for that if, in fact, that person exists and ideally can fund him or herself. Again, that might just be the same pipe dream that people have been talking about for decades. But, you know, as far as my 10 bullet points on how we can make the nation's capital work better, I don't really have that chapter. So, I guess ultimately I'm putting on my journalist cap and saying, you know, my job is to hold a mirror to a culture and hopefully, you know, maybe inject some, or at least, you know, start a conversation or elicit some kind of soul search that maybe can bring the country forward.
When you sat down to hold that mirror up, did you have a sense of just how what that image would look like?
No, not really. I was actually surprised. I didn't know it was as dispiriting as it would turn out. I mean, as people would read it. I mean, I probably was naive to think so otherwise. But no, I mean, I guess once you got going, I mean, I sort of found a voice that was maybe a little darker than I realized existed. But I sort of went with it, and I think it for better or for worse captured what a lot of people have sort of seen under, you know, under this microscope.
I think one of the interviews that I listened to before talking to you today, I I got the sense that on some level, this exercise, I don't mean to obviously more than an exercise, but for you,
right,
it was some way of, I don't know, the analogy I could use is that I was quite convinced that had I stayed on certain sitcoms, I would be significantly fatter and
right,
maybe with some major drug problem at this point in my life.
Yeah, no, it's true. I don't know if it could be worse than being a Washington insider. No, I think that's true. I mean, I think this is something where you do feel dirty after a while. And again, this is probably more, you know, self-psychoanalysis than I should probably do publicly, but I do think that this is probably a way to, if not cleanse myself, try to at least, share the culture, the dirt with people, because I do think that once you get so far inside, it's pretty hard to see yourself honestly and be in touch with the kind of things that got you involved in this town to begin with. And look, I'm a journalist. I don't want to be friends with these people. I've probably lost some fake friends in all this, which is fine. I do think that it's a story that was worth telling, and so I think that trumped everything else.
Mark Leibovich, the book is This Town. We have a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. It is that time of the day where we head into the better half, the more fun in some respects. That's maybe where we were sort of changing the marketing of the better half to the more fun half, the more, you know, jocular, jostly half of the program. You can support this program in many ways. As you know, we have a sponsor, CredoMobile.com, and we have three more days, I guess, of the deal that they are giving to majority reporters. You can get up to $350 to pay off your change fee if you're changing from another carrier. They will credit your Credo bill. They will also give you 25% off of data, and you get true unlimited data. You already know that Credo Mobile funds both the 1% of its revenues goes to progressive nonprofits, and also funds Credo Action, which is out there fighting for a lot of our shared ideals. So check it out today. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. You can find the links on the front page of Majority FM. Of course, becoming a member of this program at majority.fm is the best way to support it. If you like hearing 30-minute uninterrupted interviews with people that maybe you could see them for 10 minutes on Morning Joe and everybody can talk about, I don't know, something stupid. Or you can hear them on this program and get a better, more in-depth interview. If you want to support that endeavor because you enjoy it, by all means, it's going to cost you like 35 cents a day. Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, we got a Amazon link at the front page of Majority FM. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our link. For gosh sakes, we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You want to be a part of the program? I just remembered to put on my IM. And you can also call the program at 646-257-3920. Matt and Michael are signaling to me to remind people that the instant message is you can either do it from majority.fm@jabber.org from any client or from still on AOL instant message, Majority FM. Many different ways to participate in the program. When we come back, I'm going to go through this medical device story. We've talked about it quite a bit, but there's more stories out that we want to talk about.
We also have to get to what is easily my favorite story of the day. The bigot who attacked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We'll probably lead with that. That's a funny story. A funny.
Really it's
hilarious.
You know. There's nothing like bigots who are so bigoted that they don't even know who they're committing a hate crime against. Also, the implications of global warming. on home values of people who have seaside homes. And we'll go take a little bit of a deep dive into what David Dayan has talked to us about, which came up in the discussion about the movie about the Fed that we spoke to last week. Big hedge funds are buying up a lot of foreclosed property and then opening up large slumlords. And, well, you can imagine the rest almost. Maybe we'll talk about Gene Sperling. I don't know if I can stomach it right now. And looks like the LA Times sort of blew it on their iPad purchases. All right, all that and more when we come back.